once again to From the Center, a podcast by the Center for Western Studies. I'm Jack Bao, on faculty at the Center for Western Studies, joined as always by my friend, colleague, and troubadour extraordinaire, John Hodges. Sir, how you doing?
I'm doing okay, Jack. I'm doing okay. I'm just trying to figure out how this song goes. Do you remember that it's Advent after all,
and
we're talking about Christmas songs and all, and I know, O little town of Bethlehem, how still we see thee lie above thy deep and dreamless sleep, the silent stars go by. Yet, and then where does it go from there? Yet in thy dark street shineth the everlasting.
You're disappointing me so much right now.
Yet in thy dark street shineth the everlasting light.
It hurt my ears.
There's something wrong with that. Why does it... Oh. Yet in thy dark street shineth the everlasting light. That's how it goes.
There you go.
That's interesting.
That dip right there.
For a minute there, I'd forgotten. No, I hadn't forgotten.
How dare you. Both your Christian and your conductor license are revoked. forgetting the tune of A Christmas Carol.
That's like to say to my memory.
but it's interesting, though, because I think it's actually proper to say that it's better the way it's written than the way I played it the first time.
How dare you?
Yet in thy dark street shineth the everlasting light.
Why is that not as good as it?
Yet in thy dark street shineth the everlasting light.
Well, you see, Hodges, it's not as good because dead white males arbitrarily constructed how that song should be done, and we've all been influenced by it by discursive practices that have inscribed it upon our brains.
That's what I was going to say.
What's a sane answer, Hodges? Or what's a better or more complete answer?
Is it just because we've always learned it that way? That's the way it's familiar, and so if you don't do it the way we already know, then it's not as good? Or is there actually something going on there? I would say there's something connecting the melody with the meaning of the words, because the first two lines are about Bethlehem, right? O little town of Bethlehem, how still we see thee lie. Above thy deep and dreamless sleep, the silent stars go by. It's a good little bit of poetry about the quiet city of Bethlehem at night, silent stars going by. And then it says this word, yet in thy dark streets shineth the everlasting light. What an amazing thing to say in this little town of Bethlehem that nobody knows about, nobody pays any attention to. Did anything good come out of Bethlehem? Well, yeah. In thy dark streets shines something that is everlasting. So why not change the melody? In other words, if you sing, O little town of Bethlehem, how still we see thee lie, the second time, above thy deep and dreamless sleep, the silent stars go by.
Right.
Now why not use the same melody? Yet in thy dark street shineth the everlasting light. But it isn't the same thing, is it? It's something new. In the text, yet, and then we have something new in the melody to corroborate it or to reflect it.
Right.
It's
form matching content, right?
That's it. It's the form of the melody is actually matching the meaning of the words. The word yet should change your attention, shouldn't it? Yet in thy dark streets shineth. Now, there's no G sharp in C major. We've been in C major all this time, right? Mm-hmm. But there's no chord, E chord with a G sharp in it, in C major. So you're wandering out of the key signature. Yet in thy dark street shineth. And it plays the part of what they call a five chord of the six in C major. The everlasting light. But there it is, standing there, asking to go back to A minor again, but it doesn't. It goes from that five of six chord to this, back to C major again. The hopes and fears of all the years are met in thee tonight. So you have a line about Bethlehem and another line about Bethlehem, and then you have this weird notion that something is happening there that's different. And then it comes back to Bethlehem and says, the hopes and fears of all the years are met in thee, Bethlehem. Back to C major again. The outline of the melody actually, and the harmony, actually reflects the meaning of the lines of the poetry. That makes it a better song.
Yeah, it's almost like there's a potential within the poetry that the music helps enrich or bring out further.
That's right.
If that makes sense?
That's right. So it's possible to write a better song than a worse song. It's possible, actually, to make, no matter how many people like it or don't like it, it can objectively be better.
Yeah, I know most people don't like that idea of objectively better, but I don't know, when you play Little Town of Bethlehem and you switch between the two, it can't just be that convention is what's making it not sound right.
Right.
You know, right. Especially when you unpack and explain, no, there is a logic behind it. And that logic actually brings something out of the poetry that was there already.
Right.
Like a potency within it, but the music makes it actual, like brings it out further. Which I think is part of what the creative process is anyway. You come to something whose potentials are not fully realized, like raw material of different sort of stages of development, and you do something to it that brings out of it what's already there, or something that's, you know, something that could have been there.
And you see it in lots of other art, too. For example, let's say when we were at the Brooks Museum just the other day, we took the students to the Brooks Museum here in Memphis, and they have some paintings that are sort of in the line of English Romantic painting, 19th century Romantics like Constable, John Constable. You think part of what these English landscape painters were trying to get across is the almost religious aspect of being in nature. And so it's not surprising then that when they paint these landscapes, the sky is massive, the trees are huge, and beneath them all, maybe you see a few off in the distance people, in a little skull, or maybe they're hoeing a garden, or they're walking in the woods or something. But that's that contrast of size is part of the composition that gets across the meaning, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Of the point that the artist is trying to make.
Why are you talking about Christmas songs, Hodges?
Well, I thought because this is Advent and coming up on Christmas next week, and it dawned on me that maybe what we really needed to do was just have a Christmas issue on our podcast.
A Christmas special. What?
Yeah.
We don't want to discuss like the depths and depravities of cultural Marxism. Are you saying we should do something lighthearted, obvious?
Yeah, and I have invited all of our favorite rock and roll stars and our favorite actors and actresses and so on to be here for the Christmas special, and all of them turned me down. So it's just you and me.
Oh, okay. I was wondering why we had so many empty chairs in here.
Yeah, but I thought it'd be fun to talk about
Christmas
and what it means to us. And it's always been my favorite time of the year.
Might as well. Well, let's start here. What was Christmas like for you as a kid? Was it like, was there like a sort of consistent idea you had about celebrating Christmas, or did it change over time? I'm talking about when we were younger. I know
yeah.
it changes over
yeah.
time when, you know, as
well,
we get older.
When I was a child, I guess, we had a basement in our house, and we had finished it. You know, my dad was very good with his hands and had finished off this basement. So we had a nice cozy place to sit downstairs, and we would put the Christmas tree down there.
Was it a real tree, I assume?
Oh, yes. My mother insisted on a real tree all the time. And I know that may sound snobbish to some, but it smelled so good. She even liked to have a cedar tree,
ooh,
which was unusual because they were prickly and difficult to work with and so on, but they smell so good.
Right.
So she was always about
snobby,
that.
Snobby, pure treeist.
Pure treeist. That's what they called me as a child. You're a treeist.
Pure treeism.
Back then, we didn't have so many ideologies to choose from.
I know. What a barbaric time.
Before the Enlightenment. But anyway, we had a great time every year. We would come downstairs to the basement, to the big rug and the great tree and Santa Claus would have come and put up our train set and our you know, toys and things and put bows on bicycles and all sorts of crazy things.
You guys did Santa?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
when
yeah.
did you first find out that Santa wasn't real?
What, huh? What do you mean, not real?
I'm joking. That's an utter joke.
Not real? Nobody's ever told me that before.
I just shattered the innocence that's held together your composure
years.
For all your life, haven't I?
My folks were lots of fun about all that, and we would leave out, you know, cocoa and cookies for Santa Claus. And, of course, the next morning we'd get a little note thanking us for them. But it was, I noticed one year that happened to be in my mother's handwriting. So I knew there was something fishy about all this.
Something fishy.
If I hadn't figured it out by then. Of course, I was in college then, so no, I'm kidding.
Oh, my God.
But I saw this really great meme the other day where a kid had put out cookies and the dad had put out tacos and a bottle of wine and things like that.
Yeah.
And the dad had says to the kid, "Trust me, kid, I know what Santa wants."
Oh, my gosh. That reminds me of a Calvin Hobbes comic where Calvin was like setting out the cookies. He's like, "I'm laying out cookies for Santa." And his dad is just sitting in a chair reading a book going, "That's nice." And Calvin's like, "What do you think Santa would like with that? Some milk?" And the dad, without looking up, is like, "I think Santa would prefer a cold beer." And off panel, you're the mom going, "Dear."
Yeah. So she was always trying to keep him from ruining poor Calvin.
Oh my gosh.
Mom was.
The one memory for myself when I was growing up, the consistency, and it was such a consistency that even when there was no necessity for it anymore, I just made it happen, is in our living room. Okay, so first of all, my mom, we always use artificial because we didn't, you know, we were snobbish about being artificial because, you know, it was like we didn't want to mess with like a real tree.
It's a lot of trouble.
It's a lot of trouble, although the rewards can pay off, like high risk, high reward pay off. We just like, we'll just get a tree. We'll go with it. And my mom had developed over many, many years a philosophy of tree decoration.
Oh, okay.
That actually I coined a term for it. And I tell people it's called incrustation. All right. And it takes a long time to develop, but the basic idea is that you start out, you know, in your first Christmas, you've got like basic ornament packs, you know,
okay.
And you sort of work with those. But, you know, people will, you know, like Christmas thingies or even other times
like
of the year.
They give you some
ornaments. They'll give you some, like, some nice
things.
Ornaments,
sure,
right?
Sure.
Stuff like that. And over the years, you go buy a couple new ones,
sure,
so on and so forth.
Sure.
And my mom, being a quintessential girly girl, loved everything sparkly. Like, as time went on, what happened is most of, like, the ordinary sort of just balls, you know, just, like, ornament balls that were kind of unadorned, stuff like that, slowly but surely would disappear and be replaced by things that were more sparkly or colorful.
Okay.
And you know, had shimmer and shine to it. And eventually it got to a point where all we had were nothing but all the shimmery and shiny stuff. Mm. And the philosophy was, okay, you build up that shimmery, shiny collection. And then when it came to lights, you know, pre-lit trees changed our world because before then, you had to, like, string your own tree.
Right.
Right? But, like, the way we would do it is buy, like, multiple boxes of strings, and we would go to each branch and wrap each branch.
Oh, wow. Right?
Like, we wouldn't just loop around the tree.
Uh-huh.
We would, like, wrap each branch. It was such an ordeal.
Man, that's
my
a lot
dad,
of lights.
My dad and my brother and I did it. And by my dad, my brother and I mean my dad and my brother because they were like the hyper-perfectionist about it. And I just,
oh, yeah.
I was like, I learned very quickly to just step back.
Let them handle it.
I would hold the string and make sure it didn't get the string of lights, make sure it didn't get tangled. But other than that, I kind of let them deal with it. But that you would wrap every branch
with light.
So it's just fully like, just full of light.
That's intense.
And then when it came, it was multicolored light.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then we came to ornaments, like the smaller ones, the still shiny ones, you put inside the tree. Like you went into the depths of it and filled it up.
Near the trunk.
Like the most impressive ones you put on the outside.
Okay.
And so what happened is you just had layer upon layer of lights and shiny ornaments all throughout all the layers of the tree.
Jeez.
And so when it turned on, it looked like a Fabergé egg.
Wow.
Like it just would light up with like all these colors and stuff. And somehow or another, it was not gaudy,
oh.
You know, which was kind of the incredible part. Like, my mom I guess she, in some way, whether by accident or by intention, she knew what she was doing.
Mm-hmm.
Because somehow, even with all that stuff in it, it never came off as gaudy. It always came off as spectacular, which was pretty impressive.
That's great.
So there's the tree building, but I remember, the memory I remember that was so essential that I even, you know, kept it going, was that in our living room, we had this grandmother clock, you know, which is basically like a small grandfather clock that mounts on a wall.
Okay.
And for a long time, it was always... on, you know, we always would wind it up and it would always just tick, tick,
mm-hmm,
you know, back and forth. Made a very distinct ticking noise and its chimes were really nice.
That's lovely.
We still have that grandmother clock. I actually took it with me because I liked it so much. But, you know, as I got older, we didn't really keep up with winding it and it just kind of became sort of a decoration.
Uh-huh.
All right. But I remember as a kid, there was a thing where on Christmas morning, I would be one of the first people up,
mm-hmm,
right? And, you know, my brother might go to the bathroom or something, but I would get up and I would go out to the living room and I would be there by myself. And I would turn on the tree and I would sit in the living room and it's like quiet with the tree, but the only noise is the ticking of the
ticking
clock.
Ticking the clock, sure.
And that was me. That was like a weird little quiet time I had with myself,
uh-huh,
before everyone else came there. And I remember as I grew up, even though like the clock became more of a decoration than an actual clock, every Christmas morning... for a long time, when I went out there, I would wind up the clock so I could sit there quietly and have the ticking
and
back
hear
and forth.
It.
So I could still hear it.
Yeah.
So that's like something,
that's lovely.
One thing I associate with it.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
Now I'm talking like across the board, not just even childhood.
Yeah, yeah.
Like it could be anything like that's unique, or it's stuff that you just do every year, but every time you think about it, it just makes you think of Christmas.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, I've always loved decorating the tree, so all your stories about decorating make a lot of sense to me. We've, like I said, had real trees, and so I love the smell of it. But I also always had the job, my dad always had the job of putting the lights on the tree, and then once he was finished, then my mother and my brother and I would take over and we would put all the ornaments you see on the tree, and we didn't have only shiny ones, but we had ornaments that we recognized, we remembered from year to year. And you know, after so many years, they're so familiar that it's a tree full of memories.
Yeah.
You know, of past Christmases and all that. And Day and I have continued that same tradition with Mason, our son, in that I now put the lights on the tree, and she usually ends up putting all the decorations on. I might help a little bit. A lot of times our students every year are here to help with decorating the tree. This is the first year we've been in our new house, and so it's the first time we've had a tree in this living room.
It's nice. And it's looking good.
Yeah.
Day can tell you the background of every single ornament on that tree. She knows them all. Some of them are from trips I've made overseas. You know, when I was conducting overseas, I'd have come back with little trinkets and little things. Ukrainian wooden spoons, for example, I see there. We've got a couple of ornaments on there that Mason made when he was in kindergarten or something, you know, that are kind of important to us. And so they're on there, and you know, that kind of thing. Things from Prague. I remember buying some ornaments in Prague when I was there, and so they're on there. And Slovakia, from Bratislava, Slovakia, and Vienna, and other places where I had been visiting and conducting or speaking.
Any one of those in particular stand out to you?
Well, the Ukrainian ones in particular. I can see that hand-painted wooden spoon. Do you see that with the big?
The red handle.
Yeah, the red handle. That's one of them. There are a couple of them up there. And then the little musical instrument, I think, is one of the ones I got from Prague when I was there. And there's some angels, too, that were made out of not clay, but maybe dough, like cookie dough, only then lacquered, you know, so that you can't eat them. But they're made, inside they're kind of soft.
Okay.
So you have to be careful with them. They can be broken. Yeah. But they're on there. I think I bought those on that St. Charles Bridge in Prague. So all of them have some meaning. Some of them are from my childhood. Some that my mother loved, my dad let us have. There are little musical instruments all over because of my background, I guess. But
this is how my wife does. She Christmas tree. Well, in her family, all the ornaments were like that. They had a story behind it some way. Uh-huh. And they're like, what her family, one of the things they did is they had four kids. And so every Christmas, one of the gifts the kids would get was an ornament for that Christmas.
Yes, right. Oh, lovely. Yeah.
And you do that every year. You eventually get like a nice group of ornaments per kid. And so like it was like whatever the parents' ornaments were plus each kid's set of ornaments made the ornaments for the tree.
Oh, yeah.
And they're also ornaments from like places they went and events they happened. But one of the nice things was that the idea is that if a kid gets married and move out, they take all their ornaments with them.
Oh, I see.
So they have like an ornament starter pack.
Uh-huh.
So like our tree, which is a tiny little tree because we don't really have the room or the money for a big one right now. But it's full of all her little ornaments. And they're not sparkly or shiny, but it's like this. They're all meaningful. Like they'll have something that they mean or have a history behind them or something like that.
That's great.
Some of them are on vacations we took. We have this little shiny glass octopus we got at the Tennessee Aquarium.
Oh, perfect. That's the idea. So, and you remember all those wonderful times.
Yeah. And one of them is an ornament students got me one year, and it is a big, fat, round ornament of Chesterton. It's just a Chesterton ornament.
Perfect.
He's big and round. He's got his glasses and his hair and his mustache. It's
It's
really heavy.
Who is this Chesterton person you're always talking about?
Father Chesterton.
Father Chesterton. Oh, yeah. Related
to Father Christmas.
Okay. I had a story. One year when Mason was very young, he must have been maybe five or six, something like that. Mason and I would always go out by ourselves to try and find something for Mom, you see, for Christmas. And on the way back home, we drove by this animal shelter. Mm-hmm. And he was looking out the window. And he turned to me kind of in a daze and said, "Is that where we'll take our dog when we have our puppy?" And I said, "What?" And he clapped his hand over his mouth, just like that. Oh, no, he's let the beans spill, you see. Wouldn't tell me anything more. I said, "Mason?" He said, "I'm not going to say anything else." Well, he forgot and had let me know that I was going to get a dog. They had gotten me a dog.
Oh.
Well, later on, a day or two later, I had bought something for Day, and I was trying to find the right spot in the house to hide it so she wouldn't find it accidentally. You know,
right.
I didn't want her to catch on before I had wrapped it. So I went out we had a van out there, kind of our family van, and I opened up the back because I knew in the back there was an old tarpaulin back there.
So. Okay.
And I thought, well, I'm just going to put it under the tarp. See, nobody will ever look for it there. She's not doing any of that looking, snooping anywhere. Mm-hmm. So I lifted up the tarp, and underneath the tarp, there was something there. It was a 5 million pound bag of dog food. And I knew then and there something was going on for sure, you see. So,
oh boy.
I said something to them about it, and this is like 3 days before Christmas. And they both looked at each other and said, "Well, the dog's out of the bag," you know, kind of thing. So they said, "Well, would you like to get your present now?" And I said, "Sure." And they brought me down Duncan.
Yeah, I was about to say.
It was my
Duncan.
This little puppy. He wasn't but 7 weeks old, something like that. Little golden retriever puppy. And it was the prettiest thing you've ever seen. Dark gold color.
Yeah.
And that dog became my best friend for 10 years. Mm. That dog was an amazing, amazing dog. Greatest gift I probably have ever had. Mm. And when he died, it was left a real hole in our family.
Yeah.
But that was that great Christmas when they let me have a puppy.
I knew that. I don't know that Day really wanted to have a dog, but she knew how much I wanted to have.
Right.
I grew up with a dog all the time, and she had never had a dog before. She became very close to that dog, too.
That feels like a quintessential Christmas thing. My favorite gift was a puppy.
I got a puppy. And I wasn't
Christmas.
A kid either. I was.
You didn't want a Red Ryder BB gun with the with the lever action and the.
Well, you know what happens. You always put somebody's eye out.
Oh, my goodness. I'm trying to think of what was a super, like, meaningful present for mine, because it's all fog in my brain.
Oh, yeah.
I remember, like, things I remember about, like, Christmassy stuff, decorating the tree. It was the same thing every year, okay? Christmas did not officially start until after Thanksgiving dinner, right? Not just after Thanksgiving, but after the dinner, because we would have the dinner at, like, 2 or 3. And then at like 5, everyone was done. And for like 2 hours, everybody napped. And then somewhere in the evening around 7 or 8, because there was no school the next day and stuff like that. And we would like, that's when we would pull out all the Christmas stuff and start putting up the Christmas tree. And it wasn't Christmas. And so we started playing the Carpenter's Christmas Portrait.
Oh, their album, I've heard that.
Right?
Yeah, sure.
That album. And so it's like, it was a thing where it was like, it was forbidden to play that. And you couldn't just play that at any point of the Christmas thing. It was the thing that kicked it off.
I see.
Every time.
I see.
And so it was before that a cappella Carpenter band, whoever they were, came kicking in with It Came Upon a Midnight Clear. It's a very unmistakable sort of beginning.
Okay.
As soon as they started singing, that McChristmas began. Like that was it.
And that was always Thursday night late, huh?
Thursday night.
Uh-huh. I see.
We can't do that much anymore these days, but that was how it was. So like that... That sort of start of it, that opening sort of, I don't know what you would call it, that opening sort of couple of bars of how they sing it.
Mm-hmm.
If I ever hear it, it always makes me think of, you know, Christmas as a kid.
Sure.
That's how it always started.
Was it? I'm like that too. I think we kind of anticipated Christmas every year too. We didn't really go to church when I was a young person, and I didn't really become a serious believer until I was out of graduate school or just finishing grad school. But as a child, we wouldn't go to church very much. But when I began to learn about the church calendar, then I realized that Christmas really doesn't start until the 25th, right?
Right.
Well, who can wait that long to start celebrating Christmas? I thought, that's crazy. But there's this thing called Advent.
Yeah.
And the more I got into, the more I delved into Advent and its purpose in the church calendar, the more I realized how important it is in our lives. Because this whole idea of anticipation makes the event even more powerful, doesn't it? When you jump right from Halloween into Christmas, like so many people do now, it's a different thing. But if you don't do that, if you actually wait for Christmas to happen, if you anticipate it with these 4 weeks of Advent, it acts a little bit like a frame around a picture. You know, you've got an event in the picture, the Christmas event itself, the incarnation.
Yeah.
But then you've got a frame around it that sets it off, that gives it its parameters, and because of that limitation around it like that, you can see it more clearly, like a diamond well put in a setting, you know, in a ring setting or something.
Yeah, like a lot of people have Advent calendars,
right?
Which are a lot
right.
of fun. I remember I had one as a kid. I don't think we called it Advent because we didn't take into all that Catholic poopery. But we had one that, like, I can't remember. I think it was like something that we magnetized to the fridge, and like it was like cardboard scene of like a castle or something, and each door or window in the castle,
oh,
was, like,
yeah.
you open it up, like almost like it's a pop out book kind of thing. Open up,
uh-huh.
And inside of it was like, you know, the number 1 or 2 or whatever, going all the way down to 25.
Sure.
And so that, you know, waking up every day to like open another little window or door thing was like a big deal. It meant you were just one day closer.
Sure.
So forth. Oh, and of course, when you're a kid, Christmas is about toys.
Right.
So there is a bigger anticipation. Although I remember, you know, so I went through, you know, toy phase. And then when I got into my teenage years and I kind of was trying to figure out what I was about, all my gifts kind of switched to like books and movies. Because I was like I was already starting to realize I was like a cultural kind of person. I wanted to check out culture. But there was at some point, I don't remember when, I made this decision about birthdays as well, but at some point, I think because of Amazon, at some point I decided I can get books and movies on my own time, right? Mm-hmm. Christmas, birthdays too, but Christmas is a time for gifts. Mm-hmm. So let's ask for things that are actually gifts. Mm-hmm. And I remember the first year I decided to implement that on Christmas, because I had a Christmas list and I was like, putting out a few things here and there. But I'm starting to understand why my dad struggles to make Christmas lists, because he just is kind of like, oh, I don't need anything. And we're like, and I've got enough of my mom in me that's like, no, everybody's opening gifts and stuff. And so we have to like twist his arm to make a list.
Oh, yeah.
But as I was getting like older, I suddenly realized like, my gosh, you know, there's a lot of things I can just buy myself and it's like nothing feels special.
Oh, yeah.
So I was making a list and I had like three or four things. I was not checking it twice, but I was making a list. And I just thought to myself, this is Christmas. This gets just something that's just stupid. Like, you just, like, you don't need it. You just want it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought to myself, what's something ridiculous I can ask for that is just because just a want? It serves no other practical function. And so what I wanted is I wanted Aragorn's ring from the Lord of the Rings movies.
Oh, yeah.
This weird, like, silver double red. Like, sure. In the extended edition of The Two Towers, for you extremely nerdy out there, Saruman like describes it, and he opens a book and you see it. It's like two serpents coiled around, one's biting one and the other one's crowned, and there's like a green gemstone.
Wow.
And so I cast about online, or like actually before I even knew about Etsy or online stuff, there was some catalog that does like crazy jewelry.
Uh-huh.
And they had a version of Aragorn's ring that was like a good quality version of it. And so I asked for that for Christmas. And I got it, and that ring.
And somebody found it for you.
Oh, yeah. Somebody found it for me, got it, and I wore that thing. I still have it. My wedding ring has kind of dislodged it from where I used to have it. But I still have it. But for years, that was like part of my standard repertoire. I had like two or three rings I would always wear, and that was always one.
That's great.
Because I always associated myself. But the movie and the book character, which are different versions of Aragorn, but I like both of them. Was like, so that was a pretty big deal, was getting that right.
He's a great character.
You know, I have another story now that I think about it. One of the things that that we used to do was guess what was in the package, right? Wow. And my father was the all-time greatest guesser. He would take that package.
Well, he worked for the NSA. So
he did. I think that must have had something to do with it. But yeah, he would take a package and he would shake it and he'd feel the weight of it and he'd squeeze it and we'd say, "Come on, Dad, get on with it. Open the package. We're you know anxious for him to get it started." And he, "No, I'm not ready yet." And he would think and pass and then he would say, "That is a sweater." And my mother would be crestfallen, you know, like he's guessed again. And I remember one year she said, "Anybody could figure that out. What color is it?"
Ooh.
And he said, it is green. And he opened it up, and sure enough, it was a green sweater. And we just gave up. We just said, this is incredible. He's got like sixth sense or something. So we decided to start trying to throw him by the way we wrapped something.
Yeah.
See? So let's say we were going to give him a tie or a CD in a CD case or something. Well, those are very obvious boxes, right?
Right.
So you have to think of some way to throw him off. So what we do is we take his CD or his tie or his pair of gloves or whatever it was, and we put it in a big box, far bigger than it, you know, and tape it to the side so it wouldn't rattle around.
Yeah.
And then we put a cinder block in it, too, just to throw off the weight, you know.
Yeah.
And that led to crazier and crazier ways to actually wrap the outside of the present. So my dad began to see this was great fun, so he would do it too. And he and my brother and I would wrap each other's presents in the strangest possible way. And you know how you try to make a present look pretty, right?
Right.
And a bow and a nice wrapping paper and so on. Well, we would use the last bit of wrapping paper, you know, on one side of the box, and then we'd use newspaper to cover the rest of it, and then maybe take the tube, you know, that the wrapping paper comes in and tape that to the side of it, and then put a little piece of ribbon stuck to the end of the tube, you know, because it needed a ribbon. And they got uglier and uglier and uglier. So it became the great fun was to see how ugly you could wrap a present. And my mother, sweetheart that she was, she would say, I don't mind you boys doing that with each other, but don't wrap my presents like that. Okay. I want them to be pretty. So we'd all make hers okay.
Oh, yeah.
But then we'd admire each other's, you know, horrible, horrible wrapping. And we made all sorts of comments as though they were the greatest of art, you know, modern art accomplishments in modern art, you know.
Oh, my gosh.
So it was great fun. And one year, we were in Virginia, where my dad is living now, and he's got a garage right off of his kitchen. And he has a sitting room in the kitchen. We were all sitting around the sitting room. And I said, I'm going to go out and wrap presents in the garage. And they said, oh, that's fine. So I went out there, and with all this in their background, for 20 years now, we've been doing our presents this way.
Yeah.
So I went out there, and I turned on the electric drill, and so you could hear like this, and the table saw, you know, and I would clank his hammers against things, you know, in there.
Yeah.
And they were just on the floor in the other room. They had no idea what I was doing.
Right.
But they knew I was wrapping presents, you know,
right.
Clank, clank, clank. It was great fun. So that's one of our sort of ongoing gags.
So one of an ongoing gag, speaking of ongoing wrapping gags.
Oh, yeah.
I almost said wrapping gig, which is a totally another thing.
That's a different thing altogether.
That's another thing altogether. Well, my grandmother, my mom's mom, when she was alive, I don't remember how she started this, but once she started it, it became a regularly expected tradition.
Mm-hmm.
There was always one gift that was for my brother and I, or like we each had. It was usually whatever the gift was, it was similar versions of something, and so like I had one and my brother had the other.
Oh, right, right. That's how we did too.
But there was always some gift that was like that, where the way she wrapped it was like multi-layered. Like she would wrap it once, then she would put it in a box, close it, and then wrap it again, and then put that in a box and wrap it again.
Uh-huh.
And, wow. I mean, sometimes it was absurd. Like, like when she first did it, it was just a joke. But within, like, I don't know, 20 years of her life, she had, like, mastered into this art form where it was more, like you said, it was more and more absurd.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she'd find all kinds of weird ways. If it was, like, a, I don't know, $50 gift card to something.
Uh-huh.
She would like wrap the gift card and then stick it inside like a little jewelry pouch and put that in a box and then wrap up the box but stick that in a shoe box with like a bunch of other little boxes that we had to figure out which one was the right box. And you had to like wrap up that one, which was an even larger box, but wrap that one, but put then that one in a bag, and then the bag would like, and it was just like all these different like layers and layers and layers.
Love it. Love it.
I feel like my brother and I at one point counted how many layers and figured out like what was the most she had ever done, but I don't remember anymore. It was absurd. Like you would just rip it open. It was all different wrapping paper. Like every single layer, every single time. So you rip it away, and there's just more wrapping paper. Rip it away, more wrapping paper. You know, it was like postmodern Wizard of Oz. Behind the curtain is not the wizard, just more curtains. Just more curtains going on.
I love it. Oh, that's funny.
So that was nice. The only other like wrapping of something I remember that I thought was good, but it wasn't silly. It was like very clever and touching. Was my wife got me a gift where it was this box. Well, the gift wasn't a box, but like you know, it was in a box. And when I unwrapped it, you know, the box was closed. And on the top of it, she had written, I love you in every sense of the word. And she underlined sense.
Uh-huh.
So when I opened the box, there were five individually wrapped things. And one said touch. And one said taste. And one said hearing. So like, I opened the touch one, and it was a sweater.
Oh.
And I opened up the taste one, and it was some kind of chocolates.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I think I opened up the hearing one, and it was like a gift card to iTunes or something like that.
Sure.
And the sight one, I can't remember, it might have been a movie or something like that. So it was like, she did some of that, and it was just super
very clever.
Right, she's a very, I call her...
a thoughtful lady.
Oh, she's going to hate me. I call her my elven alchemist, because she's such a nerd, and she's so pretty, and she just is an absolute, like, she's an absolute, like, wizard with things. When she sets her mind, she always, like, wants to make something that's really special, and it's going to drive her nuts because she's hyper-perfectionistic, but she really wants to go for it. She wants to experiment and try it out. All right, she makes her own laundry. She's making her own laundry detergents.
Really?
Like, I'll walk into the kitchen, and I'll see, like, this yellow custard-looking mass inside of a pot, and it smells faintly lemony. And I'm like, you make lemon custard? She's like, nope, dishwasher detergent. And she just, like, stirs it up and stuff like that. And I'm like, good grief. I didn't even know these things were possible. And she's like, yep. I was like,
That's very impressive.
It is very
what
nice.
A girl.
It's like, it's something that makes you realize, this is a sidebar, but it makes you realize why domesticity is not stupid or dumb or boring.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's like, you know, it is not just your domain, it is your laboratory.
Uh-huh.
Right? It's like, like hyper levels of domesticity.
Oh, I love it.
Another thing we used to do when Mason was young was I would do riddles for him.
Mm.
And so he would have a box under the tree that he'd open, and it would only have a card in it that had a riddle. And that, if he could answer that riddle, then it would take him somewhere in the house to another card that would, you answer that riddle, it would take you to another house, another place in the house, and so on. So there was like five or so, six of these stages. So he'd have to go from the tree to under the welcome mat at the front door, and then out to the back house where such and such was, and then under the banana bowl in the kitchen or whatever, and he'd have to figure out from the riddle all those places. Once he figured them out, then he would finally get to the point where the present was, and it was usually a present that was worth finding. I remember one year he really wanted to get a hamster, and so we bought him a couple of hamsters, and we put him in a cage in the back house so that he wouldn't find them, and then he had to wander about till he, you know, was led out to the back house.
Yes.
But he hated that.
Can't
I just have my present? Why do I have to worry about all these?
I remember my brother.
I think down deep inside, he kind of got a kick out.
We usually did hot and cold, but I mean, clues.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But clues were also fun, too. And we enjoyed it because we knew my parents would save that for like the big gifts. Because we learned very quickly there's like a hierarchy of presents, so there's always one that's like, this is the most important one.
This is your big present,
This year, and usually that was the one that was hidden somewhere, or like you had to go searching for it. And they were always fun.
Yeah, that's great. Back to Advent for a second. Mm-hmm. I had a quote I wanted to read you, one I know you'd appreciate, from Augustine. That's Saint Augustine. And it has to do with Advent and the idea of anticipation of Christmas, and in particular about hope. And he says this: certainly hope is very necessary for us in our exile. It is what consoles us on the journey. When the traveler, after all, finds it wearisome walking along, he puts up with the fatigue precisely because he hopes to arrive. Rob him of any hope of arriving, and immediately his strength for walking is broken. So the hope also which we have here is part and parcel of the justice of our exile and our journey. And I thought that's really worthwhile. And reminds me of why it is that Advent is worth pursuing and celebrating, as it were, because just like it's important for us to look forward to Christmas, I think it's important for us to look forward to heaven. And if you don't have that to look forward to in this life, don't you become weary of the difficulties of life? You have more strength to put up with and have more patience maybe with one another and with your circumstances. If you are faithfully hoping, for the future. So Advent is a time to practice, in a sense, that hoping, that exercise of hope for the day that's coming.
It reminds me of, I thought I would avoid frustrations, but it does remind me of frustration. It's amazing how our culture has words or a part of its heritage that they just don't know what they mean anymore. And so the versions we usually get are just kind of dried out of whatever it was that they meant. So like faith, hope, and love are like the three great theological virtues in the tradition of the church. And those words are still out there, and people can give them some sort of like significance, but it's always wrong. Like, whenever I see this a lot in sort of the circles I walk into, which is like pop cultural nerdy stuff, you know, you'll have a show or an episode where somebody learns to have hope, you know, or faith.
Mm-hmm.
But hope and faith is just some sort of feeling about things. You know, it's not based in anything.
Oh, yeah.
Right. I remember one character in a show was very despairing about their chances of succeeding. But after, like, going through this little whatever in the episode, he ends it by having hope about those succeed. Now, why does he think they're going to succeed? He doesn't know. He just has hope that they will.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not based in anything. It's not like, it's not, because, like, in Scripture, hope always, like, in the Greek, now I'm getting really nerdy, but in the Greek, it always has this, it's tangled up in this idea of expectation,
mm-hmm.
right? It's not just some optimism about things. You know, well, I hope it all turns out good or something like that.
Right, right.
It's not this. Right. Optimism, it's an expectation of something that's been promised.
Yeah.
Right? So it actually has a real object.
And promised by someone who's reliable.
Right.
And based on something that actually has happened and makes it possible for you to know that things are going to be that way in the future.
Yeah. And love and faith are the same way. It's like faith is just some sort of heart thing where you just feel it. And I remember another character in another show said, you know, it's faith. You don't understand it. You just have it. And it's like,
yeah.
What does that even mean? It's like, and the idea that faith, you know, scripturally speaking, faith, the word there is like connected to like persuasion, which implies an argument. All right. So you've received some kind of data and you are persuaded by that data and you believe in it.
Uh-huh.
All right.
Uh-huh.
So it's like, again, it has an object. It's not just some sort of optimistic feeling you have about things. It's an object. And love is the same way. You know, it's not just some sort of feeling. And it's nice, I guess, that if you're steeped in the Christian tradition, if you really are steeped in it, you know, things like Advent help you remember the actual biblical and thus true understanding of hope. That's not just some sort of blank optimism you just feel about things.
Right.
Because maybe it's a sunny day or something like that, and you just feel hopeful.
Hope everything works out.
Yeah, or whatever. Or when people say, well, I'm very hopeful that things are going to be okay. What they just mean is right now they feel really optimistic.
That's right.
Right?
That's right.
But hope as like an expectation of an actual promised thing, an objective thing that's been promised is very different.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Very
and
much
Jesus
so.
Was one of the things that was promised.
That's right. That's right. And we know God and know his character and we know what he's promised. And we can be sure that it's going to happen. And faith, we're told in Hebrews, is the assurance of things hoped for. So they're connected together, even. But I just thought that it's good for us to practice that consciously at certain times of the year, you know. And so the church fathers that crafted this time they call Advent, which is really the first part of the year, by the way. You know, the first Sunday of Advent is supposed to be the first of the church calendar.
Yeah.
But it's an opportunity for us to practice some things that we. That we don't ordinarily do, mostly because we live in a world that is impatient. We want things to happen very quickly. We want the bottom line of something. We want the sort of...
We don't appreciate mediation.
No, we don't want anything to actually stand between us and the thing that we want.
Yeah. Speaking of great expectations...
Mm-hmm.
Favorite...
You're a Dickens fan.
I don't know what you're talking about. Favorite Christmas food?
Ooh, favorite Christmas food.
I mean, it could be something that you have at Christmas dinner, or it could be something that you have at, like, a Christmas party, or just, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
like, a favorite Christmas food.
I always used to like to, I know this is silly, but I used to like to make Chex Mix every year.
I was kind of
enamored of that. It's kind of high in carbs, and I'm doing less carbs these days.
Aww.
So I don't make that now anymore. But it reminds me of a quick story I'll tell you about.
Sure.
A friend of mine used to tell this story, that when his kids were growing up, his wife would always make this jello salad, you know, with mm-hmm. fruit in it, nuts and fruit and stuff.
Yeah.
Everybody knows what that is. But they only did it at Christmas time.
Right.
Okay. Well, it became their tradition for their family to have this salad on a special day, Christmas. And one day they had gone out in the middle of summer. They were going to some kind of a, you know, 4th of July picnic or something. And somebody brought Jell-O salad to the picnic, right?
Uh-oh.
And he said, and my little boy, you know, was 7 years old or whatever, said, kind of turned to me, saw it and turned to me and with, you know, whispered kind of intently, "Dad, did you see that? They've got Jell-O salad, and it isn't even Christmas." And he uses it, and I'll make the same point. He used it for the idea that we should have certain traditions that we make special, right? And
right.
And actually, we don't know. This wasn't his point, but I'll make this point. We don't know that Jesus was born on the 25th of December, right? We know
yeah.
We're not saying that that was his birthday.
Right.
But we make a day of the year specially set aside to celebrate that birth because it's so important. And so, in a sense, the 25th of December is our Jell-O salad. You know, it's our tradition. We made it up. It could have been another day. Probably was another day.
I feel like you've made this point before.
Have I?
This sounds familiar. I feel like there was a podcast episode way back about Jell-O salad. And
oh, did I bring it up before?
Yeah.
Oh,
well, no, but this was like years ago. So
okay.
This is jogging my memory.
Okay.
It's a good point.
It's an interesting point because really what we're trying to do is craft a set of traditions in our year that remind us of the important things, you see. And there's nothing special about Jell-O salad. There's nothing special about the 25th of December. But we make it that way, and we celebrate it that way, and as a result, we have a kind of a rhythm to our lives because of it.
As sort of a general note, once you get out and you start like having your own family and you have to like, you know, whatever you grew up with sort of transfers over there.
Sure, sure.
Whether you want to
good.
Or not, because, you know, some people don't grow up in the best families. But the more I'm like out and about and making my own life, the more I understand how utterly grateful I am for the life I had growing up.
Because
mm-hmm. looking back at
Me
it,
too.
I'm like... It was full of, you know, well, some of the stuff it was full of was good Christmas and good gifts and family and good food.
Yes.
Okay? Like that was one of
yes.
like it was one of those things, good food. And we appreciated food, very hobbit-like appreciation of food. And so at Christmas, I mean, there's Christmas dinner, but then on Christmas Day you have your own stuff,
mm-hmm.
right? And so there's multiple items. Of Christmas dinner... You know, I prefer Christmas dinner sometimes to Thanksgiving because I prefer ham over turkey.
Uh-huh.
But when it came, there was a dish that came one year, and when it came, I demanded it be there every year because it was so great. And it was something called squash casserole.
Ooh.
And it was like squash, like sliced up squash and like diced red peppers and some kind of spices and some kind of cream of something, soup probably. And then something... breadcrumbs or something done over it and all baked together.
Mm-hmm.
And I never knew squash could taste so good. But it's like, when I think of that, it's like, that's a Christmas dinner dish.
I know what you mean. And we used to have something that was sweet potato casserole that was mashed up sweet potatoes and a layer of, you know, probably a combination of breadcrumbs and sugar and cinnamon and, you know, flour and all that on the top, and chopped up pecans.
Ooh.
And all baked like that. So the top of it was crunchy and sweet, and underneath it was this wonderful. Was special for us.
At my in-law's house at Thanksgiving, apparently my mother-in-law makes some kind of sweet potato casserole that is demanded. There was one year she decided not to make it, and like the whole family revolted. But it's just basically sweetest sweet potatoes, and there's an incredible layer of like a broiled marshmallow layer.
Maybe
on
it had marshmallows in it too.
Yeah,
I bet it
did.
Thing. Yeah.
On Christmas Day, so it's like Christmas dinner with squash guys. On Christmas Day, Christmas Day is dangerous.
Oh yeah.
Because we only had two meals. Like one was the meal we got when we woke up, and then the next was like a dinner thing. But the dinner thing was extremely dangerous because it was just all finger foods. Like little pinwheel things and little quiches and like just little things. And finger, my wife and I have a saying, it's called death by finger food. Because finger foods are so deceptive, you always feel like, I could fit one more in, you know, like that. And then one more turns into another, another, another.
And they're so good.
So I always think of all those finger foods. But I also think we started something when I was a teenager where we found these two dishes that were two different kind of breakfast dishes. One was a hash brown casserole, and the other one was a sausage casserole. And the sausage casserole was like you took two packs of like croissant roll things. You like open it up and you just unrolled the. You didn't make out croissants. You just unrolled the thing. Just use the dough. You unrolled it into a pan, in a greased pan, and then you had sausage and cream cheese that you had cooked together in a thing.
That's what we do too for Christmas morning.
Right. You put it in there, put another layer, and you bake it, and it makes this wonderful. Yeah. I can't remember. It's not sausage casserole. I can't remember what it's called. It's called something else.
Oh, it's so good.
But yeah, you like cut out little slices, like bars of like this doughy, sausagey goodness.
Mm-hmm.
And the hash brown casserole is just like shredded hash browns, sharp cheddar cheese. Probably a cream of mushroom or something like that to like hold it all together.
Mm-hmm.
And then a layer of Ritz crackers that have been like rounded up and then shaken in a bag full of like melted butter.
Oh boy.
And you just put on it. And that's all dangerous, right? It's just like incredibly dangerous, but so good. It's
so good.
Deliciously, awesomely wonderful. You people out there who think Christmas is just a materialistic time to be ugly, awful people. Eat some hash brown casserole and shut up. Like, just Merry Christmas, you filthy animals.
Well, it makes for a happy home and something to rally around, and time with your family is so important. And to recognize the gift that we've been given from Jesus, of course, as a foundation for all the gift giving and receiving that that we do. It's a beautiful time.
That's a point I just make over and over again. Gifts are the point.
Yeah.
Right? Giving and receiving. I mean, what better, more spectacular way to like celebrate the very reality of the incarnation and the life of the Trinity itself, other than the giving of giving and receiving of gifts out of love. I mean, for goodness sake.
So what kind of Christmas music do you like to listen to nowadays?
Well, let's see. Like, when I was growing up, it was just strictly like the Carpenters and Mannheim Steamroller.
Oh, yeah, right.
And then we discovered Trans-Siberian Orchestra. So, you know, all the, I guess, usual stuff. I can't remember when it was. It was probably my post-Crichton days that I stumbled upon learning to appreciate Christmas carols.
Oh, yeah.
Like, well, not just even like the ones we know, but like older ones or ones you didn't really know all the time.
There are a lot of them.
I think the one that's coming straight to my mind right now that sort of opened my eyes, I guess, to like how deep they are. And here's another instance of somebody who understands a song and knows how to put the right music arrangement to it so you really get it. Fernando Ortega had a Christmas album, and on there was Let All Mortal Flesh Keep Silence.
Oh, wonderful.
Which I had never heard of before.
Good Advent hymn.
Right? I'd never heard of it before. But he sang it, and if you never listen to Fernando Ortega, he's very, very unhurried in what he does. It's very soft's not the right word, but he understands like how to be quietly profound about something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, let all mortal flesh keep silent, and with fear and trembling stand, as...
Ponder nothing earthly minded,
forth blessings in his hand, Christ our God to earth descended. Mm-hmm.
His full homage to demand.
Demand, right? Which was like pretty present. But it was the, gosh, I can't remember if it's the second or the third verse where it was like rank on rank, the host of heaven.
Yes.
It's the one where it says that as the light of light descended.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
And this idea of like rank on rank, the host of heaven, watch as the light of light descends.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just something mm-hmm. about that idea that it just comes down, just the incarnation being the light of light descends. It's like, you know, for in thy dark street shineth the everlasting light. Sort of idea was captured in that moment. So it was that. And so now, over the last few years, I try to pay attention to, like, if there's an older Christmas carol,
mm-hmm.
I try to pay attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
So one recently I've been liking is Come Thou Long Expected Jesus.
Oh, it's lovely, yeah.
Yeah, which is another Advent one, I believe.
Come Thou Long Expected Jesus.
There's a band I listen to that I've recommended in the past, I think. They're called Future of Forestry.
Oh, yeah.
And they release Advent albums. All right, they don't call them Christmas albums. They'll release Advent albums. And the last one they did, called Light Has Come, had Come Thou Long Expected Jesus.
Yeah.
But they had in it, like, there's the original Wesley, I think it was Charles Wesley, wrote it. And the original one had, like, two lines or two lyrics. But apparently later on, additional lyrics were added to it by other people.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this one lyric. So, you know, it's Come Thou Long Expected Jesus, born to set thy people free.
Oh, yes.
All right, from our fears and sins release us, let us find our rest in thee, and Israel's strength and consolation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there was this line. Where is it? Yes, it says, there's this additional line that they sing called, come to earth to taste our sadness.
Mm-hmm.
All right? He who glories knew no end.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this idea of, this idea that, like Chesterton talking about, the idea that a man has his back to the wall is no more than we already knew, but the idea that God could have his back to the wall is like a revolutionary concept.
Right, right.
And it's the idea that God is not this distant voice in the heavens or this non-present sort of authority, but actually stepped into the world and tasted our sadness.
Mm.
Like, he tasted our sorrow and our pain, and he knew what it meant, right? He tasted the sorrows of death and rejection and betrayal and, you know, poverty and, you know, misunderstanding and all the sort of frustrations of life that we go through,
mm-hmm.
including separation from God,
mm-hmm.
right? He tasted our sadness. He whose glories knew no end.
Wow.
And it's like that idea is still revolutionary because, I don't know, I feel like people keep forgetting that. Mm-hmm. They still want to project God out as just this big booming voice in the sky. Like, or the non-present sort of authority figure. And the idea that he actually, what is it Dorothy Sayer said, that whatever game he's playing with us, he kept the rules and played fair.
Mm-hmm.
That when he was a man, he played the man.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's still such an incredibly important idea.
Yeah. Yeah, that's wonderful. As I was saying, I didn't really become a believer until 25. So there were plenty of teenage years when I would go with my friends caroling. We'd go sing Christmas carols around the neighborhood, which was a fun thing to do because I like being with my friends and all. And we sang all the famous Christmas carols, but we'd sing just the first verse of them because mm-hmm. that's all we knew of them.
Yeah.
You can sing Silent Night anytime. Everybody knows it. Joy to the World. But when you actually dig into the second, third, fourth, fifth verses of some of these hymns, you begin to realize just how evangelical, evangelistic they were, and how profound they were. I remember thinking O Little Town of Bethlehem is a good one. There's a line that goes, how silently the wondrous gift is given. And it ends with the line, where meek souls will receive him still, the dear Christ enters in.
Yeah.
So it's a very evangelistic, concept. It's all about accepting him and trusting in him and living for him and so on. There were theological verses that I'd never made sense of until I learned the Nicene Creed. I was thinking about, O Come All Ye Faithful, where it says,
God of God, light of light, very God of, you know, all that Nicene language is in there. Begotten, not created. That line is in one of the verses. That was pretty cool. But I think my favorite one is an inner verse of Joy to the World. And we talked about it. I mentioned it when we sang that song last Saturday here at our house. You know, we had our caroling party last Saturday. We had about 32 people here singing, and it was great fun. But one of the lines in Joy to the World is, "No more let sin and sorrows grow, nor thorns infest the ground. Mm-hmm. He comes to make his blessings flow," there's the rhyme, "far as the curse is found."
Yeah.
I just love that picture. This is all about overcoming the brokenness of even the creation, you know. The thorny ground is a sign of the curse of God on the ground.
Yeah.
And it's going to be overcome.
It's the beginning of the defeat of evil.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's a glorious, glorious verse.
I think going to when I moved from one church I was in to a more high churchish Presbyterian church, I also started to appreciate the older carols better. Because they were definitely not afraid to do like the third, fourth, and fifth verse.
Right. Right.
So sometimes they highly emphasized, you know, the begotten, not created, and all that stuff.
Which was light very of nice. Light.
Although I remember, for some reason, in the midst of all this, on a funnier note, I remember hearing a story where a teacher asked all the kids in her class, I don't know, they're like six or seven or whatever, she asked them as sort of like a fun Christmassy thing, and no, this is not a metaphor for me, I did not do this. So I heard a teacher with her little kids in her class, she asked them to draw a picture that represented their favorite Christmas carol.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So if it was like Jingle Bells, they would draw bells, or We Three Kings, or whatever that is, they would draw the Three Kings and all that. Well, there was this one kid who his favorite was Silent Night.
Mm-hmm.
And so he drew this picture, and she, like, when he brought it to the teacher, she looked at it. It was a picture, it was a nativity scene, right? Mm-hmm. This kind of was about. So it was like a you know, crude looking stable, and there was like the, you know, the usual suspects. There was like three wise men and a couple of shepherds. Uh-huh. There's Mary and Joseph and Jesus. But in the corner, there was this other guy who was really fat. He was like a big round man.
Hmm.
Just sort of standing there. And he didn't look like a wise man. But he wasn't standing with the shepherds. He was just like standing in the stable with Mary. He just was there.
Mm-hmm.
And the teacher's like, "This is very good." He said, "But who's this?" So she pointed at that guy, and the boy looked at it, and he's like, "Oh, that's Round John Virgin."
Oh, wonderful.
What?
That's glorious.
It's like Round John Virgin.
I was working as a music director in a little church, and it was summertime, and I was thinking, what could we do for Christmas this year? And I had a little choir and a little handbell choir, and actually four people there that played recorders, Renaissance recorders, you know, so they had a little Renaissance recorder ensemble that they put together, and an organ and a piano and like that. And I thought, you know, Bach being kind of my hero, because he would write for whoever he had. If he had a good chorus, then he wrote some of his big choral things. If he had a good orchestra, he wrote some of his orchestral things. Soloists and so on, he would just write for the forces that he had. And I thought about that, and I thought, well, what can I write? Because we need something for Christmas that would be our own. And I started in, had this crazy notion, because at the time I was young and foolish and didn't know that that it was impossible to do these things.
That's the best time to do impossible things?
Absolutely. So I wrote this thing that was turned out to be a 7-movement Christmas cantata.
I remember this. Did you do this at Second Pres?
I have played it at Second Pres,
okay, yeah. I remember
that. We did it a couple of times there, actually.
This was before.
Did you ever hear it?
I went to go hear it. This was back when I knew of you as the legend. John Hodges from Crichton. I didn't know anything about the center, but I went, yeah, I went to hear it.
Yeah, how about that? Well, that's great.
You took everyone back into, like, the choir practice room was, like, behind the sanctuary somewhere. Yeah. You took people who wanted to go back there, and you, like, took,
oh,
like,
and talked about it beforehand,
I think, actually, it was afterhand, like, afterwards for anyone who wanted, but it was, like, 30 minutes to an hour. You just sit there, and you sort of unpacked, like, things you were doing, which I found fascinating.
Well, it was a lot of fun to do, and I thought... The story of Christmas in the Bible actually has some elements in it that are often not done, kind of inexplicably left out. But if you want to do the whole story, you have to include them, it seemed to me. So one of them, for example, is the genealogy in Matthew, you know, that leads all the way up to the parents of Jesus.
Right.
Or the genealogy in Luke, which is a different one, but leads the same direction. And there's that. But then the other part that nobody ever seemed to talk about was the slaughter of the children.
Yeah, I was thinking.
Which
that.
Is so horrible, right? Yeah. Horrifying. But it's part of the story. And so I wrote it out with a narrator to read the bits that we were going to sing about. And then we'd sing a number and then go back and the narrator would fill in. And then we'd sing another number like that. And about, I don't know, 45 minutes worth of music. It was a good long piece. But the part that we did that I wanted to point out was this sixth movement was the slaughter of the children. And so we did the verses, the Old Testament verses, in Ramah, cries are heard of wailing and weeping for Rachel's children there. She refuses to be consoled.
Yeah.
And it's about this anticipation of this horror, right? But it's in the Old Testament. And so we sang that, and it grows to a fever pitch. And eventually the choir is just about screaming, the children are no more. And it's unbearable. It's unbearable.
Yeah.
And at the end of it, we had this handbell choir, right? So at the end of that movement... The handbells have been a big part of it all the way through, playing in a kind of, not exactly atonal, but kind of a very dissonant way throughout the entire work. And at the very end, all of that climax comes down to one bell ringing over and over again, over and over again. And it's this C, to be a C. And it was as though it were... you know, tolling for the dead children, one for each child, and it was truly awful. And then we made a transition, but the bell kept going, and the narrator came in, and without announcement, said Abraham was the father of Isaac.
Who was the father of Jacob, the father of Judah, the father of Perez, the father of Hezron.
And the bell kept
going.
The
father of Ram.
And it was like the bell was ringing the births then of the genealogy in Matthew all the way up to Jesus, you see. Huh. And we had the children's choir. There was a children's choir too. And had the children's choir sing... a line from Hark the Herald Angels Sing, which is, mild he laid his glory by, born that man no more may die. And after all of that about the children dying, you see, to have the children singing, it was impossible. Overwhelming.
Yeah. After all that death, here comes the birth of one.
And then to transfer death, that very bell into from a death bell, from a death knell, to the one bell for each of the births in the genealogy, and then finally by the time he finishes narrating all the way down to the birth of Jesus, the congregation sings "Hark the Herald Angels Sing."
You see. This is why I love Christmas. It's because Jesus is the hero.
Right.
Right. Oh, there was a quote I remember from C.S. Lewis that was in, I think, Letters to Malcolm, I think, about prayer.
chiefly on prayer.
But I think it was in that one where he talked about that Christmas is basically that, you know, the dragon slayer has come.
Yeah.
That's basically what it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, as corny or cheesy as some people might find it, that's the thought that just really animates me about Christmas, that this is the coming of the great hero, the one who overthrows the great dragons.
Yeah.
Right? The great enemies that have, you know, the great enemy death and, you know, Satan, who has used death to, like, torment everybody and with great, you know. Which leads me, I guess, somewhat smoothly into, I guess, the last thing we'll ask about, which is favorite Christmas verses. Like the passages or the scriptures that where you capture Christmas. And the one that gets me, the one that years ago I just thought solidified for me why I think Chris just captures Christmas to me, was actually in 1 John.
Okay.
Because there's a verse in 1 John chapter 3, I think, where it says, "For this cause the Son of Man was manifested, that he might destroy the works of the devil." Right?
Beautiful.
Here's why Jesus came, to beat the bad guy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's why he came.
And suddenly all of the myths and the legends and the fairy tales that you know, and all the modern ones, even of, you know, putting rings in fires and all that, come alive, because they're all echoes of or reflections of or imitations of that one central story, that there really was a dragon and there really was somebody that came to destroy him.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Well, I think one comes to me right off is in Isaiah 9, where Isaiah has just written about how people who have turned away from God are walking in darkness. Mm-hmm. And you think about Jesus being the light of the world, coming into the world. And the verse that always strikes me is Isaiah 9, I think it's verse 2. I'm not looking at it, but I think that's what it is. That says, "The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. And eventually, for unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given." And it's a prophetic word, isn't it, about this final incarnation finally happening. It changes the world. And it was such an event that we actually restructured how we count our years in accordance with it, don't we?
Yes.
Much to the chagrin of our culture today, changing BC to BCE and AD to CE.
Yes.
But it really did come about because of the birth of this man. So that's one that really strikes me. And I guess the other one, of course, is when the shepherds have the angel appear to them and says, "I want you to know what's happening." And it says, "And suddenly there was a heavenly host of angels saying, 'Glory to God in the highest.'" And you can't you can't get around that as a musician, because the history of the liturgy of the church has always, up until today, included the Latin for that, "Gloria in excelsis Deo."
Yeah.
And even people who don't believe in high church, don't like high church liturgies and so on, right? We still sing that. But if you go back to the liturgies, you see that the earliest church services had "Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace to those on whom his favor rests." That's the awkward translation we do now, but "Gloria in excelsis Deo et in terra pax hominibus." So it's a glorious time to be, and it's a moment of transcendent light that comes into the world at this time of the year that can change the hearts of all of us if we but let it.
In this cross, God did not cause heaven and earth.
up to end on a lighter note, I suppose. Recommendations, if you will allow me.
Hmm.
Recommended Christmas movie.
Ooh, okay. All right.
I can go first if you haven't thought of one.
Please.
So the Christmas movie, I grew up with, like, there's like classics for every generation.
Sure.
You know, like sure. For some people, It's a Wonderful Life, Miracle on 34th
yeah,
Street.
That's a good one.
There are like classics. When I grew up, it was things like Home Alone.
Oh, sure.
It was like a classic.
That was a Christmas movie.
Yeah, it was a Christmas movie. That,
right.
Home Alone, I mean, that's not the one I'm going to recommend because I don't think I have to recommend it because it speaks for itself. But I know like the soundtrack for that was by John Williams and it was amazing. Like there's so many. He wrote a song in there called Precious Memories, which is like the Christmas song that came out of it.
Oh, yeah.
It's very beautiful. But the music, the one I'm going to recommend because it's just a guilty pleasure of mine, is called Jingle All the Way.
Okay.
And it came out, I don't know, late 90s, early 2000s. It's an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. Because Arnold had a reputation for, like, either he would do ridiculous action movies where he could bulge his muscles as much as he could, or he would do these just weird comedy, sometimes family-friendly stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes he would do both. But this was, like, a weird family-friendly comedy thing where he's a dad who, you know, isn't paying attention and is kind of... is a good guy, but he's kind of neglecting his family because he's really busy with his own business. And he really disappoints his son badly and he wants to make it up to him. So he promises his son that he's going to get him this really, really important Christmas gift. It's like the Tickle Me Elmo of that year.
Okay.
I'll get it for him. The problem is he promises him this the day before Christmas Eve. So Christmas Eve comes up and he's going to sneak out of the house, go find his toy. But like I said,
and ain't one to be found.
This is the Tickle Me Elmo of like that year. And so the whole movie is this ridiculous journey as he's going around town to every toy store, doing back alley deals with like shady Santa Claus, mall Santa Claus workers. And Sinbad is in it, the comedian Sinbad. He plays this crazy mailman who's also trying to get it. And they become like these weird rivals who like are constantly getting each other's way. It's very stupid. But I love that movie so much because it's just so ridiculous.
Yeah.
And I remember when I was a teenager when I first saw it, and I just watched it like a bajillion times. So my Christmas movie recommendation is the silly and stupid Jingle All the Way.
Jingle All the Way.
So that's mine. What's yours?
Well, of course, there's the classic. The classic everybody knows is Santa Claus Conquers the Martians.
Have you ever heard of that?
I have heard of this, but I forgot about it. Remind me.
It's truly horrible. It's one of these really, really bad movies, you know, just cheesy, stupid, you know, silly. Anyway, Santa Claus Conquers the Martians. It's the whole plot in the title. Santa Claus Conquers the Martians. No, I wouldn't recommend. I mean,
does he conquer them with gifts, or does he like?
No, I won't give away the ending.
Okay.
Well, you'd have to see it to believe it. But it's it's one of those movies like Troll 2 that's so bad it's fun to watch.
Yeah,
you know?
I got you.
But it's terrible. But no, that's not the one I want to recommend. Of course, my favorite one I think is White Christmas.
Oh, with Bing Crosby.
With Bing Crosby and Danny Kaye. And we always have to watch that every year.
Yeah.
We always have to watch that sometime during the Christmas season. But in addition to that, I guess It's a Wonderful Life and A Christmas Carol both come in maybe a very close second. And both of those, I think both of those are really, really fine stories for the same reason. Because in each case, in It's a Wonderful Life, George Bailey finds out what life would be like if he had never been born.
Right.
And Scrooge finds out what life would be like if he continued in the path he's already in, right?
Right.
So each of them gets a chance to see things that they wouldn't understand or don't normally understand. But the glorious thing about them is that there are changes of heart in each case, right? But without changes of circumstance.
Yeah.
So they don't actually wake up from their dream and the world is a different place and now they can live in that.
Right.
It's that they've interiorly, you know, changed.
Right.
Their insides have changed. Their heart has changed. George Bailey suddenly loves the house, the old drafty house. And, you know, suddenly loves the fact that the sheriff is there to arrest him and all that. Right? That's okay. All that is okay because of this change of heart. The same thing with Scrooge. Scrooge wakes up and he's got the same money. He's got the same, you know... Bob Cratchit working for him and Cratchit's kid is still lame, and all the rest of the world is the same way it was when he went to sleep, but he's different.
Yeah.
And I think if there's anything that the world needs to remember, it's that God comes to change our hearts, and that's what shows up in both of those movies, so I'd recommend them at any time to anybody.
Excellent.
Well, that's all for now.
Can I make a plug for our... we have... For anybody who wants to donate $100 or more to the center,
yes.
we're willing to give each of them a special gift, a recording, an audio recording of Dickens's famous A Christmas Carol.
Yes.
In its original form, right? Unabridged. It's 3.5 hours long.
Oof.
But I recorded it, and we edited it here and in the studios, and we make it available for anybody who would like to donate to the center. And you can send us donations to the Center for Western Studies at 3896 St. Philip Drive in Bartlett, Tennessee, 38133. Or you can go on our website to our donate button and donate through PayPal, and we will get notice of that, and we will send you a link to that book so that you can have it before Christmas or during the week between Christmas and New Year's, as you like. Or we will mail you one in the mail if you choose to send the check in directly that way.
Nice.
Well, that's all we got time for today. This has been From the Center. We're saying Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
And we will see you next time.
And maybe next year.
Yeah.